I just got done looking at a DVD of Lloyd Pye about hominoids. 20 million years, he says, of suppressed history. This was incredible. We'll talk about this and a number of other subjects in a moment with our very special guest tonight, Lloyd Pye, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd Pye graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology. He joined the U.S. Army and became an agent for military intelligence. During this time, Mr. Pye began an independent study of human evolution at age 30. His studies led him to conclude humans could not have possibly have evolved on Earth according to the Darwinian paradigm. By age 40, he could illustrate his belief by comparing skeletons in the so-called pre-human fossil record with those reported to belong to the world's four basic types of hominoids. Lloyd is probably best known in alternative circles as the caretaker of the famous Star Child skull. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. The complete bone cranium that looks like a hybrid between a human and some other kind of alien being. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Lloyd. How are you?
Well, George, I'm doing fine, and thank you very much for having me on again. I always appreciate it.
Well, I got done looking at your presentation that you had in Billingham, Washington, and it was absolutely stunning. You did a phenomenal job on it, so much so I'm glad you're on the program just so part of the show we can talk about the work you've been doing into Sasquatch research.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and I really would urge anyone to take a look at that. That's not money in my pocket. It's from someone else, but I thought they did a very good job with it myself.
Okay, let's get an update, if we can, on the Star Child Project. And for those people who are brand new to the show, very briefly, tell us what the Star Child is all about.
The Star Child is a skull, as you said earlier, that's a real, true bone skull, no question about it, that looks, you know, it has the outline and configuration of a human, but it's very, very different in a number of ways. The bone itself is half the weight it should be. It's half the thickness that it should be. It's two or three times as durable, as hard as it should be, and it has the morphology of something that's not entirely human. The eye sockets are different. The neck positioning is different. The way the cheeks are aligned, just everything about it, every part of it is different. It has no internal sinuses. The brain that's inside that head is much larger than it should be. We can't account for all the brain that goes in there. It's just an amazing thing, and there's so many things odd about it. It goes way beyond what you would expect from a standard deformity of any kind into something that's not entirely human, and that's what we've been trying to establish.
You've had some DNA testing, the results?
Right. The DNA testing that we've had done so far, there were two skulls found together, one that was clearly human and this one that is apparently not. And when the DNA testing was done, there are two kinds of DNA that you can recover. There's mitochondrial and there's nuclear DNA. The mitochondrial DNA is fairly easy to recover. It comes down from strictly the mother. The nuclear DNA comes out of the nucleus of the cells, and it's from both parents. With the human, very easy to recover both the mitochondrial and the nuclear. But with the Star Child, we got the mitochondrial easy enough. That's the mother's DNA. But when we went after the nuclear DNA, mother and father, suddenly the primers wouldn't work. They wouldn't pick it up. The geneticists say, well, maybe there's some kind of highly unusual degradation. And the other obvious answer is the primers that they're using, which are designed strictly for human DNA, can't find what they're looking for. So that's where we are right now, and it's going to require the creation of new primers that might be able to find, you know, the DNA, whatever it is. And basically, we'd have to build our own ladder of primers that would recover it, and we'd be able to compare the new primers with the standard human primers to see what the differences are. Very expensive process, but we're hoping someday to get the money to do that, and then we'll know for sure what it is.
You are opening up the Star Child Project website, and you're asking anyone to take a shot at drawing what the Star Child might have looked like in life, aren't you?
Exactly. What we've done, we've done a complete revamp of the Star Child website. There were two Star Child websites, the original one and the one that was created when I spent last year in England doing the sophisticated testing that we were having done there. and which is available, the results of that's available on the website. But the two websites have now been blended into one, and we're asking anyone that has artistic abilities, or if you know somebody that has artistic abilities that might be interested in trying to put a face on the skull, we will post those images if they're halfway reasonable. I mean, we don't want joke things and cartoon things, but you know, if they make a serious attempt at it, we will post them and, you know, see what people come up with. It should be very exciting and a lot of fun for those who have those abilities and those interests.
Lloyd, tonight lots of new information, and I want to talk about so many different things with you, including intelligent design, of course, the continual search for Bigfoot, Sasquatch. You've got some pretty novel ideas on how to find this creature that I want to talk to you. You'll also make five predictions, which I find fascinating. And, of course, the theories of Zachariah Sitchin cannot escape you, my friend, when we talk tonight. What have you been doing in the arena of the search for Bigfoot? Because, you know, this has been an important aspect of your career.
Right. Well, that's how I started out. I started out with hominoid research when I was a senior in college, and that was when I first stuck my toe in the water of this, and I was very impressed by it. And then later I was able to see the Minnesota Iceman when it was frozen in its block of ice and was taken around the country. I was convinced that was real too. And so I followed up that field, and it showed me that we could not have evolved here, that hominoids represented what we are told are our anthropological ancestors, the prehumans. Those beings, the prehumans, the Australopithecines and the early Homos, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and Neanderthals, those are not human. Those are ancestors of, or the ancestors of today's living hominoids. So if those belong to the hominoids, we don't fit here, but I didn't know where we fit. And that's, I just waited. I couldn't find an answer until I found the work of Zachariah Sitchin, and suddenly I had an answer. And so I knew that I could blend his work with my work and come up with something new and original and I think important, and that's what I've done.
Now, it's interesting, and it's also fascinating that some of these hominoids haven't really changed over the tens of millions of years, yet human beings all of a sudden popped up on this planet. How do you explain the difference, Lloyd?
Well, it's very simple. The hominoids are the indigenous upright walking primates of planet Earth. They belong here, and they go all the way back in time through the Miocene era. There were a group of apes called Miocene apes. Now, that we're talking apes. We're talking no tails, monkeys, like monkeys. And the apes dominated the monkeys. There were so many more of them, 50 different types around the world, maybe more. So these apes dominated from 20 million years ago to around 5 million years ago. And then suddenly something happens and only four are left, the ones that we have now, gorillas and chimps and gibbons and orangutans. And so where'd the others go? What happened to them? And furthermore, could they all have been quadrupedal? There are a group of Miocene apes that are called the short-armed apes, and it's the short-arm problem. And the short-arm problem is if you don't have arms longer than your legs, you can't locomote comfortably on all fours. You can't be a quadruped. And yet there were apes that had arms equal to the length of their legs, and they are called the short-arm Miocene apes. And it is assumed that they walked in a kind of a funny squatting, shambling kind of walk with their knuckles dragging on the ground. And this is insane. Why would they do that when all they'd have to do is just stand upright and they can walk on 2 feet? So I think it's very clear that the short-armed apes were, in fact, bipeds going back as much as 20 million years ago, and it's them that have walked out of the Miocene and become the prehumans of antiquity as far as our fossil record goes, and that they continue around the world today, every continent except Antarctica, living their lives in half the world, fully half the world is terra incognita. Most people are not aware of that, but fully half of the world as we all live in it today, belongs to us, but half of it we hardly go into at all, and that belongs to them, and that's where they live.
Lloyd, in your presentation, you showed the various steps of the hominoids through the Neanderthals to Cro-Magnon and then man. In your opinion, one, does Bigfoot exist? And I know what that answer is going to be, but I want to hear it from you again. And then after you answer it, where would you put Sasquatch in that category?
Well, Bigfoot and Sasquatch, there are four basic kinds. Excuse me, George. There are four basic kinds based on height. There are the giant kind, the 8 to 10 foot tall, and that is Bigfoot and Sasquatch. Then you have a man-sized kind, and you have two of those. They're in the 5 to 7 foot range, weigh maybe 600 pounds. And that is the abominable snowman type, and another type that are called the Almas because they dominate in Russia.
Almas?
The Almas. And then you have another kind, which are the pygmy kind, and they are the Sedapa, the Agagwe, and you remember the hobbits of a few months ago found in Indonesia?
Yes, yes, the three-footers.
Exactly, and they on 60 Minutes, the guys did the interview, and he said outright, well, yes, technically there's nothing about them that are human except they walk upright, and so they have to be as some kind of antiquated human type of being. When all they have going for them that's human-like is upright posture. Everything else about them, not a bone in their body, is human. Well, that's the way it is with all of the pre-humans up through Neanderthal. So Bigfoot Sasquatch is just Gigantopithecus, which is one of the Miocene apes, come down to present time. And the Almas and the Abominable Snowman are two different kind. Understand that. They're not alike at all. The Abominable Snowman are very primitive types. And they live only in the Himalayas, and they have very unusual feet that are designed for living on not flat land. They don't walk quite the way we do, or the way bipeds do. But the Almas are very human-like. In fact, they may be the most human-like. And then the Agagwes are just small. They're around 4 feet tall, 3 to 4 feet tall, like the Hobbit, like the Sedapa, like the Agagwes. Did I say? Yeah, the Agagwes. You have four different size categories around the world. They exist on all continents, are found on all continents except Antarctica. And eventually, probably sooner, more likely than later now, because of the technology that's getting out into the field, one of them is going to be captured or killed. One of them is going to get hit by a Mack truck somewhere. It's going to happen again. It's happened in the past with the Minnesota Iceman. It'll happen again. And eventually, science is going to have to confront that reality.
What do you think science will do when just one is found?
Well, I think, George, if I was in their shoes, I would try to do what they did with the Hobbit. It's just the freak of nature. You know, immediately they
until they found a family, then they found a family of them, right?
Exactly. But the first reaction was, "Oh, it's just a freak. It couldn't be that it's anything other than just some kind of a freak." And that was the original argument until they went out and found some more. Exactly. So now they're having to accept that they're some kind of, you know, quote, ancient human. But when the first hominoid is brought in, that will be the same tactic. It's just some kind of weird freak of nature. It'll be the second one that'll nail it down. But what the first one will do is it will put search teams out there very seriously looking for them because the reward is going to be, you know, so big. And when the second one comes in, they're really not going to have a leg to stand on. Science is going to have to change its position in a number of fields across a number of the things that we all believe and accept now. And it's just going to change a lot of things. It's going to change our day-to-day reality.
I think so, too. If you had unlimited funding, Lloyd, and you were able to put together the team to truly find Sasquatch, what would you do? How would you do it?
Well, it would really be actually pretty easy. You could get three or four of the real good helicopters that we have available to now, maybe, if possible, rent some of the Blackhawks from the military, although I know they're using them mostly in Iraq now. But that's really, you would need just some very good helicopters, muffle the engines down very quietly, which they're capable of doing. All this technology is available today.
That's
some
true.
Of that really, really good night vision heat-seeking equipment that they have, and just, we know the areas where they live. We know the, where they can be found, and just cruise the area the way they found Che Guevara all the way back into the 60s. You look down, you find the heat signature that looks like what you think, you know, it ought to look like. And then you drop a team down, you rope them down of like commandos.
So immediately, if they see what could be a family or perhaps one, what you're saying is this team is in the helicopter and they go down right away.
Exactly. They just drop down and surround it and work their way up. That's how they got Che Guevara back then. They couldn't do heat signatures the way they can do now for bodies, but they could do fires. And they knew the general area in Bolivia where he was, so they used the U-2 to scan for fires out in the wilderness. And they, when they did that, they found what they thought was the most likely one, a cluster of campfires, sent the military in to surround them, walked up the hill that they were on, and tightened the noose, and they got him. And it's the same simple technique. It would work on hominoids as well.
This team that you would send down, how many people? Would they be armed? What would their mission be? How would they accomplish this?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. If I was in charge and you asked me, I would send them in with weapons, and I would send them in with the intention of getting a body, because science is not going to tolerate much else. If you go in just to shoot film of it, they'll say somehow it was doctored. If you go in with darts, you don't really know how much juice to put into one to stop it, and if you miss, it's going to come get you. So for the protection of the people that you'd be sending in, and these are not endangered species either, so it isn't like you would be killing the last one, but if you're going in to get one to prove that they exist, I think you actually have to get one.
My gosh,
you get it.
I never thought you'd say that, Lloyd. Would you try to capture it first?
Well, I don't see how to do that and look, we talk about this in the community of hominoid research all the time, George. It isn't like we all haven't thought about it. And listen, I will tell you personally, I have not hunted, fished, or killed an animal since I was like 12 years old. I had no stomach for it personally. So that isn't my thing. But if we're going to talk about this in a rational way, if I were to send down a team of 5 or 6 or 10 guys, and they're going up to get a Bigfoot or a family, and they generally tend to go in groups.
And this would be an 8-to-10 footer we're talking about?
Yeah, this would be the big one, because that's what dominates here in this country. We have the other kind, and we may get, what if we got a juvenile? Like, excuse me, the Minnesota Iceman was a juvenile, but you can't always count on that. These things are powerful, they're fast. And while we own the night when we have our goggles on and all that, they own the night too. They have night vision ability. So it would pretty much be a fair fight. And if we were to shoot them with darts and miss or not get the right amount to stop them in their tracks, how would we know? Do you use the same amount for an elephant, for a water buffalo, for a giraffe? We don't know. And if you make a mistake, they could get to your guy and tear his head off like pulling the cherry off the top of a soda before you know it. That's how strong they are. To me, I would not risk that.
When we come back, let's talk about some of your 5 predictions, also chat about intelligent design and get into some of the thoughts of Zechariah Sitchin as well. There's lots to talk about tonight. Lloyd Pye. His book, by the way, is called Everything You Need to Know Is Wrong. We'll talk about his website, too. He's changing his main website. We'll tell you about that in a moment. And welcome to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Lloyd Pye, our guest. Lloyd, you have 5 predictions, sort of, and let's go through them all if we can, and then we'll come back and elaborate on them.
Well, first, let me say that I hope this is a better sounding reception from the phone.
Oh, you sound great now. Yes.
I would like to explain to everybody, I went out and bought a headset today for the first time. I normally do it the way I'm doing it now, just holding the receiver in my hand, but I thought I'd get into the 21st century, but it didn't work so well, so I apologize for that. But
go get a refund,
do it this way through. Now, as far as the 5 predictions that are in the DVD that you saw, these I think can be really, really important, because I think, as far as I know, this is the first time anybody's put them out in a public way. But what I say is, this: number one, the so-called prehumans are non-extinct Miocene apes. Apart from their bipedality, they share no basic characteristics with humans. none. And this is what we talked about a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the so-called pre-human stride is nothing like a modern human. They are so far apart in foot morphology and locomotive style, no reasonable comparison can or should be made. And in the DVD, I go over a lot of foot evidence, as you saw, to prove why I'm sure that's going to be true. Number three, hominoids are planet Earth's only indigenous bipedal primates. They have lived for millions of years on every continent except Antarctica. And most people are not aware of the Miocene ape history for specifically that reason. They can't be explained, so they're talked about very little by mainstream science. Number four, the fossil record from Neanderthals back through the Australopithecines contains nothing resembling a human. They are the bones of hominoids, which will prove to be apes that walked out of the Miocene era. And again, it all ties in with what we've been talking about earlier. And number five, humans are not native to planet Earth. And this is, of course, the most explosive. Along with domesticated plants and animals, we have been genetically engineered by outside intervention for unknown purposes. And, of course, that's the big one, but I'm very, very confident that that's, in the end, what is ultimately going to be determined.
Do you think Bigfoot is or was an intelligent creature?
I think they're intelligent in the way that monkeys, chimps, gorillas, like that. They can't communicate in the way that we can. They don't have the throat mechanism that we have for speaking. They can make sounds like all apes can, loud sounds, but they don't have the capacity for breaking those sounds into small little tiny parts the way we do to modulate into speech. So I think that that's a function of very high intelligence. I don't think they have that, but they are masters, absolute masters of their environment, and that's why it's so difficult for us to just go out and bring one back. They know their terrain a heck of a lot better than we do, and when we go out there, they see us, hear us, smell us much, much before we hear, see, and smell them.
How old do you think the species are? And I know we talked about the four different ones, but generally the giant ones, the ones that we see in this country primarily.
Well, you mean how old they are in a lifespan?
Well, no, not in a lifespan, but as a species. I mean,
I think they all go back to the Miocene, George, going back 20 million years. The Miocene runs from about 25 million years ago to about 5 million years ago. And I think that and in the beginning of the Miocene, at around 20 million years ago, the apes totally dominate the monkeys. There are so many more apes than there are monkeys at that point. And then suddenly something, quote, happens to all the apes and they go away. Did they really? I don't think they did. There was not any kind of a catastrophic event that would have taken them out. So I think they just live on in the parts of the world that we simply don't inhabit. We think we inhabit almost every cubic foot out there. We've either been there or lived there. None of that's true. It's just not true. There are vast areas of land that probably not a human foot's ever been on. Or if it has, it's maybe one time in 100 years. Those are the kinds of places in deep forests, jungles, swamps. That's the kind of areas that they live in.
Look, if we can get illegal aliens to come across the border and we not know where they are or see them, I'm sure there are a number of Sasquatches all over this planet and we can't find them either.
Exactly. There's plenty of room for them to roam. They stick pretty much to their own terrain. And the only time we see them generally is when we dip into one of the borders where they live or they dip into one of the borders where we live. But only at those border lines do you have the sightings. We rarely cross through deep into the heart of their territory. They don't generally come deep into the heart of our territory.
Lloyd, why haven't they evolved then over 20 million years? I mean, I would assume they're the same as they were then.
That's right. I don't really think that there is evolution, George. I think evolution, as it's been spun out by the evolution advocates, is just not true. It just doesn't happen. There's no sign of it in the fossil record. There's absolutely no sign of you know, one species developing into some higher form of the same species.
So it is what it is. It stays the way it is.
Pretty much. It's what's called stasis. What the fossil record shows is something called stasis, where something appears. Everything appears. Everybody needs to understand this. In the fossil record, everything just appears. You have strata without these things, whatever they are, and then suddenly there's strata with them, and they come fully formed. There's no evolution ever apparent anywhere. So when that, now once they're here, they can change a little bit in what's called microevolution. So you do get some of that. You get the Darwin's finches, you get the changes in the beaks, you get the changes in the tortoise shells. You get changes once they come in parts of their bodies to better adapt them to their environments. But you don't get a finch changing into a sparrow. You don't get a tortoise changing into a rhino or something. You just don't get that. You don't get any kind of movement like that. So that being the case, I don't think there's been any evolution here ever, and I don't think there's going to be. It looks, if you just go by the fossil record, that the whole of the Earth has been terraformed since the very beginning, is being terraformed now, and will probably continue to be terraformed on into the future by somebody else who has an agenda that we can only guess at.
Well, let's concentrate on that for a while, Lloyd, because that to me is just historical. You are, of course, familiar with the work of Zachariah Sitchin. Give me your thoughts on some of the things he has done. Do you think he is right on with his evaluation of the Sumerian tablets?
Well, he's on to something. He may not be right in every single thing that he says, because he's one guy working with a huge field of knowledge that nobody else really wants to touch because it's so volatile. So I'm not saying that he's perfect and no one should expect him to be, but I think he's closer to the truth than anybody else out there in terms of what the ancient history of human beings was at the time that he studies, which is around 4,000 to 6,000 years ago, the ancient Sumerians. That area that he focuses on, I think he's closer to the truth there than anybody, any certainly mainstream Sumerologist, because they have to work what they find and what they think around the accepted agenda. And Zechariah just simply ignores all that, and he goes with what logic dictates, what the language dictates, and while it's very revolutionary, it makes sense, because what he doesn't talk about, like the genetics, for example, are the things that I talk about, are the hominoids. He doesn't talk about any of that. That's why I said earlier, what I saw in his work was that I could take what I was doing, which had a huge gaping hole in it, and I could plug his information in and have a whole picture. And by taking, if you take what I do and plug it in same way, reverse with him, you get the same thing. It strengthens what he talks about, particularly the genetics. Now, we all are aware that there are breakthroughs in genetics all the time, all of which are indicating that what he says, what Zechariah Sitchin says about it, and what I say about it too for that matter, is true, that we are a genetically engineered species. We just came up in September with the revelation of the chimp genome, and so we're able to compare that now to the human genome. Now, that's our closest genetic relative. Everything we have, they ought to have. If we came from them, it should be pretty close, 98-99% the same, right? Except we have whole chunks of our genome that are completely original, found nowhere in any other primate, any other animal, any other species. So how do those things get there? It didn't happen naturally. Those things have to be put there. And so as the evidence keeps coming in, it becomes clearer and clearer, and one day or other there's going to be a tipping point that we did not evolve on planet Earth, that human beings are an add-on here, that we're a genetically engineered species, and for as volatile as that is to talk about and think about and contemplate, it is the truth, and it is going to have to be dealt with at some point.
Science does know that the Neanderthals and the modern humans walked this planet at the same time. Now, in my day, Lloyd, when I was in school, nobody would have talked about that. That would have been unheard of. You know, in, you know, according to the evolutionary twist, it would have been a smooth transition. Right. Now we know that modern human beings were there with these cave people. And how do you explain that?
Well, because they were, they're hominoids. Number one, Neanderthals are living hominoids. So it's no different than it was at any point prior to that. What happened is you, science had to have a smooth transition from beginning to end. And it was, you have this weird-looking thing, a Neanderthal, and then you have this modern-looking thing, a Cro-Magnon. One had to somehow have led into the other. The fact that they seemed to do it overnight at around 30,000 years ago, science just shrugged. Well, you know, magic happens. It happened. That's the way it is. We have Neanderthal bones, and then suddenly we have Cro-Magnon bones, and the Cro-Magnon somehow evolved. This is what you and I were taught when we were young. Well, now we know, of course, that that's just ridiculous, that there was about a 200,000-year overlap between us and them, so that we were all living at the same time on the Earth. And now the saying is, well, we somehow wiped them out. Well, why did we have to wipe them out? Why couldn't they have just gone where we couldn't get at them? Why didn't we just take a certain part of the land of the Earth, and they took another part of the land of the Earth, and everybody's continuing on living happily ever after? I think that's what happened.
And you know that when this genetic altering occurred, let me ask you this, Lloyd. Did the human beings that we know of, the way we are now, did we come down directly from other planets, maybe Mars, who knows where, or were we already on this planet and then we were altered from maybe Neanderthals or Cro-Magnon?
I think probably the latter, George. I think that you need to have a certain amount of the DNA of the place that's developed over time. You know, you put something here and you let it adapt to the environment. I think they probably took Neanderthals, whoever did it, and put a lot of their own DNA in to make the significant changes that they wanted to create us.
Okay.
But that we still have a small part of the Neanderthals in us, 5%, 10%, I don't know. But in order for us to be as well adapted as we are to the planet, that would be required, keeping in mind that we're really not very well adapted to this planet. Our skin isn't well adapted to the amount of sunlight that hits here. We're not well adapted to the amount of gravity here. We wouldn't have hemorrhoids and varicose veins and the things that we have if that were true. So we're not particularly well adapted, but we're adapted well enough to live here and to live a life out here and to be the slaves and the servants that we were apparently designed to be. But when you talk about the creation of us as a genetically engineered species, keep in mind that the evidence for this is blindingly clear to anybody that will look at it, because the primates that we supposedly descend from genetically, they all have 48 chromosomes. We have 46 chromosomes. How did we drop two whole chromosomes and become that much more sophisticated? Guess what? We didn't. Somebody, somehow, some way, took our second and third primate chromosomes, fused them together so that they take up only one space, and turned them into a single chromosome.
Why?
Now, nature supposedly can do that. That's garbage. Nature can't do that. That it has to be done in a genetics lab. But, you know, to say that, if science says that, the ball game's over. So they have to say, well, yeah, nature can do that. Nature can't do that. You can't take two chromosomes and splice them together beautifully and make one that works. Nature's not going to be able to.
And there would be no earth change event. There would be no earthly thing that would do that as well.
Right, exactly that. Furthermore, we have over 4,000 genetic disorders in our genome. Now, if we were a natural species, you can have genetic disorders that go through the gene pool, albinism, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get 4,000 plus. We've got so many more than anybody else, except for domesticated plants and animals. They have it too. They were engineered as well. I firmly believe that what happened was a group of super beings came here to the earth, and in order to turn the place into something that they could live in and enjoy and be halfway comfortable, they needed, number one, slaves and servants, but they also needed food. And so they created the domesticated animals and the domesticated plants that we have, because all of those seemed to come out of nowhere at about the same time, around 10,000 years ago. Domesticated plants, domesticated animals, and if you look at the writings of the Sumerians, which Zechariah Sitchin has found, it says that all this was done by the gods to, quote, give the gods their ease in order to make life easy for them here. And I believe that. It makes sense. It's what the genetic record indicates. And I think that over time that's going to be recognized as the exact truth of what happened.
Do you think these beings, these extraterrestrials, look like we do now, or totally different?
No, I think they look very much like we do now. You know, they said in the writings of the Sumerians, we shall make the Adamu, A-D-A-M-U, they called us Adamu plural, the Adamu in our own image, after our own likeness. Now, those who wrote the Bible took that very language from the Sumerians and just copied it down word for word into the Bible, except they took the U off the Adamu and made it Adam, but otherwise it's the same wording that the Sumerians wrote 2,000 years earlier in the Bible. And, you know, I think that's exactly what they did. They made us to look like them, to be like them, but to be better adapted to this planet than they were.
It's remarkable when this all occurred. Perhaps this is a group of beings that go from planet to planet, jump-starting planets, Lloyd.
It could be. It could well be that, because whoever's been doing it has been, at least as far as Earth goes, they've been doing it for like 5 billion years, because it's pretty clear that the first form of life on Earth, the prokaryotic bacteria, was put here just as soon as the Earth could tolerate anything. I mean, it was a seething ball of magma around 5 billion years ago, and yet, whammo, there you have prokaryotic bacteria. Not one kind, but two kinds. And it looks as if the planet got turned into a place that higher life could live. So if indeed that's true, whoever is doing this has the ability to take an incredibly long view. Time must mean nothing to them, whoever or whatever they are.
When we come back, let's talk about the name Damon Elkin, okay?
Okay.
We'll do that and talk about much more. Lloyd, by the way, at one point lived in New Orleans. There's a reason we're going to talk with him about that as well, beyond what has happened with the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd's website, of course, is lloydpie.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, Lloyd, what's new with your website, lloydpie.com, the personal one?
Oh, wow. We've had some tremendous changes on it, George. I have a new partner in life now, Amy, a girl from Australia, and it just so happens that she's a computer whiz. So she's overhauled it top to bottom. And now we've got some just really neat things in there, one of which, of course, is the seven questions that a documentary filmmaker came by not long ago to talk to me and film me, asking questions about hominoids and about intervention theory. And those seven questions are now, the answers that I give are available in little film clips that anybody can download for free. And they'll give you a good background, I think, in the hominoid issues that we were talking about earlier. Of course, there's also the DVD available through Jason Valenti that we were also talking about, and that's the one where I make the predictions and talk about extensively hominoids and intervention theory and how the two are mixed in. And I just think it's a great DVD. I don't normally push stuff that I'm in, but I push this one because I think it's really good and has the potential to be really important. And also, something that we didn't talk about earlier, but I'd like to mention, is that there's now a humor page. And you've seen me do a dinner speech, I know, and that one
yes.
that I gave and talked about the Cajun stories. That's on there. But the one I'd really like to mention to folks is where I did one talking about Brett Favre, and I did it for Art Bell, actually. So this is for Art. Art had a helmet. He's a huge Packer fan and Brett Favre fan. And we all know that Brett Favre seems to be in the twilight of his career this year.
You mean the 3-10 Packers?
Excuse me? Yeah.
But
this took place back when they were riding high and Brett was the man. And Art had bought one of their helmets and he wanted Brett to sign it. And he called a friend of mine in New Orleans who was part of his organization. And we went to try to get it signed by Brett Favre at a golf club where he was, you know, having an event. And we had to bluff our way in. And George, we had more trouble. It's a very funny story. It's 18 minutes long and it's there. And I would really urge people to give it a shot because Favre is not going to be, you know, with us apparently that much longer as a starting quarterback. And it's just something that I think will just add to his legacy because it really casts him in a good light. He's just handled it so very well when we were handling it like the bozos that we were. So I think people would really get a kick out of that if they go to the humor page. You'll see the Packer helmet and just click on that and load it up.
And you provide a lot of tapes and things for free, don't you? Where people
as
can
much
look
as
at
I can, absolutely. Yeah. I really want to get the information out. I don't think it's necessarily should be a money-making game. You have to make as much as you can to survive. That's obviously part of the game. But I really think it's important for people to inform themselves and be informed about these issues because they get so much garbage coming from the other side because the other side has the wherewithal to put it out there. They control the media, and it's very hard to get a contrary opinion out there. So, yeah, I make as much available free as I can, and the stuff that I know is out there that's good from other people, I recommend that, and I always know for sure that anything I recommend is good.
Now, you lived in New Orleans, but for how long?
Well, I was born and raised about 60 miles north of New Orleans, and then for the 6 years prior to 2004, when I moved to London working with the Star Child, I lived in Metairie. So I'm very intimate with the city, and I went to college there at Tulane. So you know, I know the city very well. I consider it my hometown, and so I was as devastated as anybody else, even though I don't live there anymore. I moved, from when I came back from London, I moved to Florida about 4 months before the storm. So I was very lucky.
There's a scene in Jaws where they're talking about there's a shark, and one guy goes, "A what?" And he was just in shock. I got to believe if anybody who's been familiar with New Orleans went there, and there's a reason we're talking about this because it's going to kind of flow into something. If anybody went to New Orleans, they'd be in shock too, wouldn't they, at this point?
Absolutely. It's just staggering. I've been back twice since it happened, and the first time was about 6 weeks ago, and I could not believe, this is after the water had drained out, I could not believe, and when you drove down the streets, as everybody says, there's just no sound. There's nobody there. There's hardly any cars on the road. But as you would go by each and every house, wherever you drove in the drowned out area, you'd see mud lines up to close to the roofs or midway up the windows or, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 to 10 feet. But in front of every house, George, this is what got me, in front of every house, there was a pile of junk about the size of an SUV, and that was the guts of the house. People had come in there, and I don't know how they did it so fast, but just about every single house had been gutted, and you saw signs everywhere. House gutting, call here, different numbers. And there, people had just moved in and had cleaned them out. But there was nothing to pick up the piles. The piles just sat there. And so it was mile after mile, and thousands of these piles of junk and cars, just mud-covered cars, cars that had been drowned completely and then dried out and had a thick layer of mud on them. It was just staggering, just staggering.
I got a story today, hurricane victims still living in barns. They're still waiting for trailers to show up. They can't get it. How would you grade FEMA in the entire group of people who are responsible for taking care of people on an A to an E basis? Would you give them a D or would you give them an
E?
I don't
see how you could give them anything other than a C minus or a D. And I think, frankly, if you ask them, they would say the same thing. Nobody was really prepared, I don't think, for the magnitude of it. And then nobody was prepared for the squabbling that goes on at the state and federal and local level either. Everybody's protecting their turf. Everybody's trying to keep from taking that ultimate responsibility. And then those that want to take responsibility, they're those trying to fight against them taking responsibility. And it just turned into a turf war. And because of that, so many things were slowed down that needed to be essential. I mean, all you have to do is look at the writings and the documentaries that have been done about it already. The National Geographic had a very good one on it that I saw recently. It was just a mess. People were just not prepared for the magnitude of the disaster. It's just that simple. And I don't think that necessarily the lessons that were learned are going to stick either, because you've always got people involved, you always have ego involved, and you always have confusion, and you always have turf protecting. And I think that's the worst part of it, that turf protecting. That slowed things down more than anything else in the beginning, and also a lot of wishful thinking by the city of New Orleans people who had all those buses just sitting there. They could have gotten people out, but so many, and we all understand, so many other hurricane warnings had been given for the city that didn't pan out. And it was, there was a lot of crying wolf, and this is the one where the wolf showed up, and people just weren't ready for it.
Those people must be under a lot of stress.
Huh. It's just horrible to know if you had a hand in making that happen. And let me say this. I went back just about 10 days ago, not this past weekend, but the weekend before that. I went back to a reunion of some college football player buddies of mine. We get together pretty regularly, and I talked to a couple of them that are high up enough now to be in positions to know. And two things that came out of this, two really, you know, anecdotes that were fairly chilling to me. One of them said that in the end, it's going to come down to the Corps of Engineers, because those canal walls were supposed to be sunk to a depth of 17 feet to hold up.
Right.
And they were only sunk to about 10 feet for costs and other reasons, and that's why they didn't hold up. But now, this one I'm not as sure about, you know, the truth of it, nor was the guy who was telling me, but he said he had it on good authority. Do you remember when all the looting broke out in
yes.
the second and third days, and everybody was terrified,
thereafter.
And there were stories of killings and rapes, and just suddenly all that went away. Just went away. The next day, it just was over with. What he says is that some groups of special forces were sent in that night. They hit the ground in the city at about 5 o'clock. And by the next morning, about 50 of those guys were out, taken out, dead. And the worst of the thugs. Now, these were thugs we're talking about.
You mean the looters were taken out?
Not just looters. The ones who were... See, the way the city is set up, you got to understand, there's a wealthy part of town called the Garden District that was on high land. And, you know, when they asked Eddie Sutton why he robbed banks, he said, that's where the money is. The thugs knew where the money was, and they were going to the Garden District. And that's where, you know, you're not just breaking into a supermarket and getting food and water to live. If you're breaking into homes in the Garden District, you're going after the jewels and the, you know, the valuable stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the guys that they took out. And it ended in a day. So for as ruthless as that sounds, I was puzzled by it. The Garden District was just sitting there like a big fat plum with nobody in town, and everybody knew it. And yet nothing was happening. It was just by the time the National Guard got there, there was almost nothing to protect. Apparently, this story that he told me is what happened. And, you know, whether it's true or not, I'm not vouching. I'm just saying that it was puzzling that it started and almost as soon as it started, it stopped.
It finished.
I think that's a plausible answer.
Tell me a little bit about Damon Elkin and who is this individual?
Well, it's Damon Elkins, number one. I got that wrong, too, and he corrected me on it. But Damon is, you know, I get contacted by a lot of people. George, I know you must as well, people who are doing work that they think relates to what I do. And a lot of them have very good stuff. I've run into a number of people that have very Andy Lloyd with the dark star theory in England and Cody Jordan with what he does with the Maya. And this gentleman, Damon Elkins, contacted me out of the blue, and he said he was tracking the path of Nibiru scientifically with data that would really impress me. And it turned out he's from Fort Smith, Arkansas, and my parents live in Monroe, Louisiana. That's about a six-hour drive, so I said, well, I'm going to be there on such and such a day if you'd like to bring your information. Well, he did, and we sat down, and about 4 hours later he left, and I was absolutely convinced. I was just blown away. And we have some of his information on your website, and people can look at what he does or what he's done. But in trying to track the path of Nibiru, the planet of the Anunnaki, the people that Sitchin and the Sumerians say came to Earth and created us, this other planet in our solar system, he's tracked a path left to us in antiquity by things that we look at and we don't see them for what they are, but he's pulled out the information from them, and it's really, to me, very stunning and very convincing. But what the pictures that you see on the website, on your website now, but on my website as well, I have it set up so people can go to either one, you see that what he's found is in antiquity, we have views of the Earth and the solar system from way outside the Earth, showing that people 2,000 years ago and then 3,000 years ago understood that the Earth was part of the solar system, was circular, was going around the sun in a time when supposedly everybody thought
everything went around the Earth.
Yeah. Center of everything. His evidence shows very clearly that that wasn't the case. And all people have to do is go and see. If you look on your website, you go to page one, I think it is, you have it listed as.
Right.
And when you see that, when you look at the first image, what you see is the galaxy, and you see galaxy center, and you see an X drawn through it. Well, that's the center of the galaxy, and the backside of it is called the anti-center, or opposite the center. And you see one of them passes through a kind of a globe there. And that globe is the general space around our solar system to about 10 times the distance from the sun to Pluto. So it's a very big area. And that's the sphere, the celestial sphere, as we would understand it. And Earth is in the center of that big sphere. Well, the sun, too. Earth, and by at that scale, the Earth and the sun are virtually the same. Then you look at something below in the next picture called the Farnese Atlas, and it's just that standard picture of Atlas holding the globe of the heavens on his back, and it's a globe. But what's neat about that is you look at those carvings on that globe, and those carvings are what you would see if you were way out in space looking in, that same picture that you just saw of the globe of the solar, you know, with the solar system in the middle of it, Earth in the middle of it. That's what you're looking at here on this Farnese Atlas. You're looking at the same view of from way out looking in. Now, how did the artist know that, and how did he get it right? Because the perspective is from way under the bottom of the ball, the bottom of the globe, and so it's pointing, so it understands. It's oriented to the center of the galaxy. Nobody back then could have known that. It's oriented to the center of the galaxy and the anti-center of the galaxy. It's just amazing, and yet there it sits. And if you look on the second picture, George, you see those three bands, those three circles going right through the sheep kind of thing right in front of it?
Yeah.
Those are ecliptics, and show the movement of things, and it could be part of the movement line for Nibiru. Now, if you go down a little farther, you see the what's called the planisphere that comes from Babylon, the Babylonians, about 600 B.C.
B.C., yeah.
And if you look at that, it's we're looking at, again, the same thing. We're looking at a view of the heavens from well below the earth, well below the sun, and we're looking, again, with an orientation toward the center of the galaxy and the anticenter. And, you know, with numbers, they indicate that. So it's like, how in the world could the people who were creating this so far back understand all these things, have any concept at all that these things were out there? And the Sumerians, we don't have this, but, I mean, this is well known from the research of Zechariah Sitchin and others. The Sumerians knew that Neptune was there, that Uranus was there, that Pluto was there. They had the correct planet count. They even wrote that Uranus and Neptune, if looked at in the heavens, from meaning out there looking at them, they looked like blue-green watery twins. Well, all of our astronomers thought that was completely wrong until Voyager went out there in the late 80s and found out that it was indeed true. What the Sumerians had written 4,000 years ago was true. It's just incredible the level of knowledge that they had. Well, these things are just, you know, they're not talked about because they're just impossible to explain.
Well, and it wasn't just them, Lloyd. You know, the Dogon tribe, they knew things. The Aborigines in Australia,
right.
They knew things. I mean, the Mayans, I'm convinced the Mayans knew things. As a matter of fact, they just found a mural of an astrological event, an old Mayan incredible mural. How do they know these things exactly?
They had to be told. I mean, they were told by the gods that were living on Earth. But because, you know, that's incredibly difficult for science to swallow and deal with. I mean, you think religion is bad, the things that religion says. I mean, science doesn't want to deal with that. They certainly don't want to deal with the idea that we're looking at proof of alien existence on the Earth in deep antiquity, in deep time. And so that's what these things mean. And one of the things we didn't get to is the Temple of Dendera in Egypt. And that's yet another view taken from very, very accurately from well under the earth, looking at the view of the constellations that you get wrapped around. Again, ideal perspective, people knowing what was going on, knowing about the center of the galaxy and where it was. This is just impossible information for these people to have without somebody coming in from out there that knew what it looked like, putting it down for them to use to model these things.
Incredible images. Stay with us, Lloyd. We'll be back in a moment. I'll tell you what, I haven't opened up Fast Blast for questions in a long time. We'll do that. Just a half hour's worth of Fast Blast questions for Lloyd Pye when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd Pye, how did you get into now the electric universe theories? How did this evolve for you?
Well, I've always had trouble with the Big Bang, George, and I know a lot of people out there listening will have problems with that too. It just sounded absurd, and every time I'd read something new, it'd be black holes or dark matter or dark energy, which was stuff they didn't know anything about. It sounded like, to me, evolutionists trying to plug holes in their theories. But I didn't know enough about astrophysics to really be able to argue it. I just wasn't comfortable with the Big Bang. And then I went to do a Nexus conference in Australia, and I met a guy named Wallace Wall Thornhill, and he's one of the top electric universe people. And I saw a presentation, and it was just like when I saw Sitchin's material. A light just went on, no pun intended, and I could see that was the answer, not gravity. Electricity. It just made so much sense. And I think if anybody out there listening believes that gravity is the source of everything in the universe, you are going to be really surprised if you'll take the time to go through this electric universe research that David Talbot and Wall Thornhill and others are doing. You're going to be really impressed, and you're going to see, I think, as clearly as I see, that evolution and the biology is all wrong today as we understand it. Similarly, astrophysics is all wrong as we understand it. It's not gravity, it's electricity that's the driving force out there. And I can tell you one sentence that makes it clear.
Sure.
If you look at the idea that gravity is at the center of it all, if you take the best understanding that we have of that and apply it to the way that galaxies spin, they should be falling apart. There's just not enough mass in the galaxies to produce the spin that we see in them. So that's why they have to create things like dark matter. But if you use electricity, electricity is 10 to the 39th power stronger than gravity. That is 10,000 billion times stronger.
Tesla understood that.
That force will do it, not gravity.
Tesla was a great supporter of this theory.
Exactly. Well, Tesla was one of the early people, and then you had Birkeland with the Birkeland currents, and then you had Hannes Alfvén, who won the Nobel. This is a well-known thing out there, George, within astrophysics circles. It's suppressed as much as possible because they know this is it. But the problem with the electric universe theory is simple. It is infinite. We live in a world where cause and effect has to rule the roost. We live in a world where there has to be reasons for things. If you accept that the universe is only 14 billion years old, well, then there's the starting point with this fictitious Big Bang thing, and that means that there's sort of a purpose in it, and it doesn't require anything else. But the electric universe is infinite. It doesn't have a beginning. And that's what science doesn't like about it, because why? It pushes the idea of what's out there closer to the world of spirituality. Now, I'm not pushing for religion. Anybody that knows me and knows my work knows that I'm not pushing for religion at all. But I do push for the truth, and the truth takes you where it takes you. And it's beginning to look to me like the electric universe is the way to go. And if so, then there is an infinite universe out there. And we don't know even a beginning of a part of what's really going on until we face up to the idea that gravity's not the answer, that Newton is wrong, that Einstein is wrong. I know that's a big bite for a lot of people to accept, that both Newton, because Einstein built his stuff on Newton. But you're going to have to ditch those two guys and start over with the electric universe, that electricity, the plasma, it's a plasma out there. And you can see an image on your website. If people go and look to page 2 and you look at the image that you have on your homepage, that beautiful swirl that looks kind of like a dress or something. That's the sun in the middle, and that's Pluto, that little dot at about 5 o'clock. That's how the sun, that's the force of the plasma swirling around. You know, everything swirls like that. The galaxy swirl like that. This swirls like that. And you know what else? What does that look like? Any strike you familiar? Hurricanes.
Hurricanes, like a hurricane,
take
sure.
That same shape. That's the fundamental shape caused by the electromagnetism, the force out there from the it's scaling. It's from the largest to the smallest. That's the forces that we're dealing with. It just makes such good sense. If people want to take a look at it, they can go to thunderbolts.info, and there is more stuff there, more pictures there than you can imagine. It will absolutely convince you. This is, to me, what I do with the world of biology and trying to show that, you know, evolution is wrong and that intervention theory is how we really got here and how everything is biologically. These guys are doing, I think, work that's every bit as important and every bit as on the nose in terms of cosmology. And all it requires is for people to take a look, and it's easy enough to get their hands on the information if they'll just take the time to do it.
Lloyd, are you a believer in a divine creator?
Well, I'm not in that sense. The anthropomorphic God of religion, no, I'm not. But I do think, George, that there's absolutely a lot more out there at a trans universe level. There's more out there than just the three dimensions, trans-dimensional level. There probably is a spiritual world out there. There may well be life after death. But it isn't in the way that I think religion casts it and twists it around so that if you're evil, you don't get to go there. I think whatever it is, it applies equally to everyone. And if there is that we all go there and we all deal with the other side when we get there.
Lloyd, that's a whole show with you, isn't it?
It would be a whole show with anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to some fast blast questions if we can. Brent from Chicago, when we talk about how did these ancients know so much about celestial events, he said, well, they didn't have to be told. There were previous, far more ancient civilizations that were suitably advanced. While DNA manipulation is still possible, the timeline is simply off, as we know humans have been here for a far, far longer time. What do you think of that?
Well, we've only been here, according to our genes, about 150,000 to 200,000 years. But we've only been sort of as we are now for the last 40,000 years or so. There was some event occurred around there around 40,000 years ago. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't highly advanced civilizations, because I believe there were. The evidence is overwhelming that there was highly advanced civilizations. But I think each of those was a result of these superior beings being, they were the gods, they were the rulers, they were the ones who made it happen, who built the edifices, the great megalithic structures around the world. Humans didn't do that. They may have helped under the guidance of these people who were, could control gravity and who could make things float and cut the stones out, you know, but that's not human beings. It's human beings maybe on the premises, but we're not in charge of that. I don't think we had the capacity now to do that, certainly not then.
Emily from Colorado wants to know if you know of, or if you've heard of, or if it's possible of human tribes in unexplored areas of this planet. She says, I'm convinced there are people living off the land that modern explorations have yet to discover.
That could well be. That could well be. Remember, they found some tribe somewhere about 15 years ago. I don't think that at all, especially in the Amazon, there could easily be tribes nobody's ever contacted before. I think, yes.
Ron from Fremont, Ohio. I've always believed we were engineered to use only 10% of our brain. This was done to keep us from becoming gods ourselves. Using 100% of our brains would open up a whole new realm of thinking. What's your take?
Exactly agree. I think that what happened was the beings that created us had to give us their brains, which I think are super brains. So I believe they had to put a partition in our brain to keep us from using all
of it. A firewall, huh?
Excuse me?
A firewall.
Yeah. And what happens is and I believe the proof for that is evident in the amazing, incredible abilities of savants. When they have damage to that firewall, to that separation, you know, thing that we have in our brains, when they have damage to that, they get insights in, they get little rays of light in, and they're able to do just phenomenal things, which we could all do. If we could drop that, when we get to the point of genetic understanding and knowledge so that we can manipulate our own genome enough to take out what they put in, we will suddenly have access to our full brains, and we will have uniformly across the board eidetic memory like the savants have, where they just remember everything they see. That capacity should be within our reach within the next, say, 200 years.
Stuart from Austin, Texas writes, actually, it could be Richard C. Hoagland hiding as Stuart from Austin, Texas. But he wants your take on Cydonia, how it might relate, and if you think it's at all possible that Martians might be a link here.
You know, I really don't know. I think it's possible that Mars at a time in the past was a way station. You know, Zechariah says that. I think it's quite possible, because Mars clearly was different than it is now, well deep into the past. So, but it's not something that I study, because, you know, Richard does have sort of a stranglehold on that kind of information, and it's just not something that I feel needs to be explored by two of us. He's doing a good job, and, you know, I think we all pretty much trust his judgment.
A writer from Lewiston wants to know, Lewiston, and he says, I can read this correctly, where are the gods? If they came here, where did they go?
Well, they didn't necessarily go anywhere. They could be, some of them at least, could be here right now, overlooking us, tapping into this conversation. I mean, who knows? There are so many reports of people living, of beings like that living in underground bases where the, you know, ships go in and out of the mountains, the hidden areas of the mountains. There are so many reports of undersea, under ocean reports of worlds down there. We know so little really about our world. It's pathetic. I mean, if the hominoids are out there and they're living the way they are and they're what they are, then how hard really would it be for highly, highly evolved alien beings to develop places to live underground in our mountain valleys or under the ocean? Yeah, I think they could very easily be around, and I would imagine that's what a lot of sightings are all about, and also, of course, abductions.
The real Richard Hoagland just sent me a message to thank you for your response, and I sent him back one that said, "You're welcome, Stuart."
Gotcha.
Buzz from the Nighthawk Zone in Waukegan, Illinois says, "My daughter thinks she may be a star child. What are some of the signs to look for that your kid could be a star child?"
Well, you know, I get an awful lot of this, George, I have to tell you, and it's people asking me to make a judgment that I'm totally unqualified to make, because I deal with the star child skull, which I think is an alien-human hybrid from 900 years ago. I would have no way to know what it looked like in real life, what it was, its mental capacities were, or anything. I don't think anybody could know that. I certainly can't. So I can't say. I think if you think you have an exceptional child, you know, you need to get it tested by qualified people, psychologists, psychotherapists, people like that, to have them tested and see if they show special abilities. I just have no way to judge.
Matt from Kansas City, Missouri, wants you to be reminded that Brett Favre is still the man.
Listen, I'm a huge Brett Favre fan, and especially that day when we met him, he was so incredible. If you watch that video, that 18-minute video that I was talking about, and you hear me describe what we did and how absurd we were that day, and yet he was incredibly gracious. And, I mean, and the guy gets bombed by this stuff practically every day of his life, and to be able to be that gracious under that kind of strain, I just came away from it with enormous respect for him. And I would hope that anybody that knows him and is hearing this, please pass this, you know, this word on to him and let him know about it, because I think he would appreciate it as another small part of his legacy.
Ed from the Big Apple, New York, love the program. Can you ask Lloyd what his opinion is of the ancient Mayans and the 2012 prophecy?
Well, the Mayans, I think, got their information straight from the horse's mouth. I think that they couldn't possibly have had an understanding of precession, which is a 25,000-year cycle that we now know is actually very accurate. They couldn't possibly have known that in their own time. So they had to be taking that information from people who were giving it to them. And if those people gave them that information and they said it all ends in 2012, I don't know if they were interpreting it correctly or not, whether it was the end of everything or just the end of another era. That I don't know. But I'll tell you, as 2012 approaches, I'm going to be getting a little tense about it.
And it's coming up fast, too, Lloyd.
I think a lot of us will. As we get closer to that, there's going to be more and more and more talk about it. But for right now, yeah, frankly, I'm a little concerned.
Can you imagine the programs we're going to have as we get close to that day?
Can't imagine it.
December 21st.
The videos, it's going to be amazing.
December 21st, 2012, apparently is a Friday night. So anything goes that night.
Party till you drop that night.
Jared, Dallastown, Pennsylvania, hoping for Mr. Pye if he could tell us who he thinks built the pyramids. Thank you.
Absolutely, without any doubt in my mind, not human beings. No way. That had to be built by these extraordinary beings because, you know, really, anybody that studies them knows those are Rolex watches. Rolex watches built to the size of mountains. We couldn't even begin to get in the ballpark of that today with everything that we have. And, in fact, on my website, I've got a wonderful string of pictures for you to see, for anybody to see. I have a series of slideshows. and under the intervention heading. And if you go there, you'll see the size of cranes that it takes to lift huge 1,000-ton stones, even 100-ton stones, and see what we need today and look at the setup involved and all that. And these people are putting these things down every, like, 8 minutes, every 8 minutes for 100 years straight, 24 hours a day, no stop for 100 years. Every 8 minutes, a stone goes into play. It's absurd. How can you have these meetings where these Egyptologists go and sit and listen to this stuff being explained to them, and they say, "Oh yeah, right, yeah, well that makes sense to me." It's absolutely ridiculous. This just sends me around the bend. The megaliths, but particularly the pyramids, absolutely not built by humans. No way.
You know, I have long believed that there was something beyond this planet that helped construct these incredible, incredible edifices.
Absolutely. No way this can be done, George, without two things. No gravity, lasers. Because when you see how those stones are put together, there's no mortar. They are put together so perfectly, it's like a hair between the stones. And when you make a mistake on a deal like that, if you're off two hairs, by the time you get to the top of it, you're looking at a mistake the size of a Volvo.
And then compare it to some of the things, you know, I went to Cancun several years ago and looked at some of the things that the Mayans did.
Yeah.
And not putting them down for some of the work. But, I mean, clearly you could see that the rocks that they cut out in the stone, I mean, had some jagged edges and it was rough. It wasn't like the pyramids.
Uh-uh. You go look at the pyramids, look at Baalbek. Look at Tiwanaku, look at in Peru and Ollanta Tambo, at Sacsayhuaman. There are places around where the connection between the stones is absolutely perfect. We can't do that.
Stay with us, Lloyd. We'll be back. We'll have an hour of phone calls now with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. And, of course, your phone calls this hour with our guest, Lloyd Pye. I've always wondered who built those pyramids. And yes, I've thought that there could have been some extraterrestrial intervention there, but also a tremendously advanced civilization that might have lived on this planet, perhaps, as Michael Cremo says, millions and millions of years ago. Let's get Lloyd's take on that. And also, let's go down to Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida, and find out how he thinks Ed Leedskalnin perhaps built that structure. We'll be back in a moment. Your calls, Lloyd Pye, on Coast to Coast AM. Couple twofold questions here, Lloyd Pye. First of all, is it possible that we could have, as Michael Cremo says, civilizations that were very advanced, that were here millions of years ago, might they have built the pyramids sometime?
Well, Michael is a good friend, and he and I just fundamentally disagree about one point. Those beings could easily have been here. I don't question that a lot of his uparts, the out-of-place artifacts that he has dug up, are real and valid. But the beings who would have been here, George, are not us. They're not human beings like us. They may have been the beings that created us, but it's pretty clear from our DNA that we, as we are today, don't exist prior to about 200,000 years ago. So whoever was here in the millions of years ago range, assuming they were, they're not us. They're something very much like us. They may have been the seed stock that created us, but it's not us.
They might have used humans whom they genetically altered to do some of the work.
Well, but it wouldn't have been millions of years ago. We don't exist as a species prior to 200,000 years ago. So whatever was doing it back then, they were doing it on their own accord, or they were doing it with somebody else. I would assume they were just doing it on their own accord, whatever they were doing. But as far as 200,000 years, that's a long time, but it isn't millions of years ago. So it's pretty clear that whatever was here, and I'm not saying that there weren't highly advanced civilizations, they just weren't us. We don't appear before about 200,000 years ago. But I also believe, like Graham Hancock says, I believe that there was a super civilization or any of the ones, Civilization One. There's so much evidence out there of advanced civilizations within fairly recent times, within, say, the last 30, 40,000 years. There was plenty of potential for very advanced civilizations here on the Earth that have just been, you know, lost to whatever disasters might have befallen them in the way that we may be facing a disaster in 2012. You just don't know. But you have to look at the evidence that's there, and the evidence is pretty clear, in my opinion.
Well, and when you talk about lost technology, think about Edward Leed Skullnan from the Coral Castle in Florida.
I couldn't believe when you said that. You know, I've just this past week read a movie script about him and his life and building the castle. There's a fellow here in Florida named Joe Bullard. Again, this is another guy that contacted
me. I know Joe.
He's
been on the show.
Oh, there you go. Well, he wrote a book about it, and I certainly think that Leed Skullnan obviously tapped into something, some lost knowledge of the past he got, because there's just no way. You're talking about a 100-pound guy moving multi-ton stones by himself in the middle of the night. You know, obviously this guy knew something that none of the rest of us know, and for whatever reason, he never let that information out into the general public. But, you know, Tesla was a lot like him, too. Tesla was like from somewhere else almost, you know.
To the phones we go now. It's your turn with Lloyd Pye, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jason from St. Joe, Missouri. Hey, George, you had a guest on quite a few months ago that believed that humans had only been around for about 6,000 years. And for your guest, I was just wondering what his opinion was on that, and I'll listen off the air.
Yes, and as you know, Lloyd, there are a number of people that subscribe, I don't, to that 6,000-year theory.
Sure.
Your take.
And that's something we should talk about. It's the creationist viewpoint that the Earth and everything was created about 10,000 years ago, and that humans are no more than 6,000 years old, according to the Bishop Usher chronicling of the who begat who in the Bible. And for those who might be interested in the ongoing and the reignited debate between intelligent design and evolution, for a very long time, creationists, those who call the young earth creationists, by hinging their arguments to the Bible and insisting that everybody had to believe that the Bible was the literal truth, they were very easy for evolutionists to dismiss because those are absurd positions. I mean, I don't mean to slight anyone's religious beliefs, but those aspects of it are just absurd from a scientific standpoint. It's clear that that's just not the way it is. That's just not reality. The Bible in that sense is just flat wrong. I mean, it's just no doubt about it. So as long as they were sticking to that position, they were easy to dismiss. But the intelligent designers are truly intelligent people. These are for the most part PhDs. And they recognize that the only way to move ahead against the evolutionists, against the Darwinists, was to uncouple from the Bible and uncouple from that strict interpretation of the 10,000, 6,000 years. And when they did that and they started playing the game strictly on the evolutionist playing field, using scientific arguments, suddenly everybody began to see, geez, these guys are making some points. It was known all along, from almost the beginning, that Darwinism, evolution, had gaping holes in it that just weren't going to be filled. And so the way it stands now, the intelligent designers have got momentum on their side because anybody that listens to their arguments knows, as I know and anybody else would, they're making very good sense at a scientific level. They are showing the truth of the matter, which is that evolution really doesn't work, but they're showing it in scientific terms. And they're not insisting that you believe the biblical interpretation of it. They're leaving that as an option for you if you want to go that way, but you don't have to. I think that in the end, that's going to be wrong, too. It's going to be intervention. It isn't going to be necessarily the anthropomorphic God of anybody's religion, not just the Christian religion or Catholic or whatever. It's going to be gods with a small g, flesh and blood beings that were here and who genetically engineered us. That much we'll understand.
Okay, go ahead, Lloyd.
Say one more thing? Because this, I think, is really important. I have on my website a little small 1,700-word essay by a biologist from South Africa. His name is Antoni V. Maluski, and he wrote this, I think, a brilliant little essay called Evolution versus Intelligent Design, Are the Gods Crazy? And he has a summation paragraph. Let me just read this and let everybody, you can go read his thing on my website if you want, but just listen to the arguments that he makes here. It is not rocket science to realize that a good theory cannot contradict itself, but evolution does so all the time and apparently shamelessly. Mutation is random except when it isn't. For example, adaptive mutation of the immune system. Mutation is confined to single bases except when it isn't. For example, polyploidy pulls a whole spare genome out of the hat. Natural selection works, except when it doesn't. For example, the relictual human appendix is as big as an eye and a lot more dangerous. Mendel rules genetics, except when he doesn't. For example, double recessive genes are mysteriously corrected in Arabidopsis. The genes express copying errors according to an inevitable molecular clock, except when they don't. For example, living fossils such as the coelacanth. DNA is the very scripture of life and the most elegant of material substitutes for gods, except when it isn't. For example, 90% of all human DNA is functionless junk. Genes are the servants of adaptation, except when they are selfish. For example, try to make head or tail of Richard Dawkins' idea of cause and effect. And last, natural selection relentlessly promotes reproductive success, except when it doesn't. For example, humans, not bunnies, rule the world. And he goes over these points. When you hear it laid out like that, and many other ways, you see evolution is sunk. It's on its way down. They don't want to accept it, and you'll hear all kind of arguments. But it is, and something is going to take its place, and that's where I think intervention eventually will be it. And that was my five predictions earlier, playing right into that.
Well said. Let's go to the phones again. First-time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
How you doing? Joe Bob from Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey, hello, Joe Bob. How are you?
I'm doing good. Love your show. It's a fabulous one tonight.
Thank you.
I was wondering about the pyramids and the people who built them. You think were extraterrestrial or God-formed people. What about the pharaohs and the guys that are buried in them? Were they godlike? And what happened to them? Where'd they disappear to? Why'd we lose the technology?
Well, Joe Bob, first of all, there's never been a body found in a pyramid. There's never been a body found in a pyramid. They were not tombs. They are just called tombs. But they weren't tombs. They were something else. They were monuments of some kind to do something with some function, but not tombs. Now, as far as the pharaohs seem to have come on the scene very long after the pyramids were there, and the pharaohs, if you go look at Egyptian history, they claimed everything they could claim. But they didn't really claim the pyramids for themselves. Egyptologists have assigned pyramids, a pyramid to Khufu, and then they assigned them to other pharaohs within a 100-year period just so they had some answers. See, what science does when it comes up against something like this for which they don't have an answer, there's no obvious answer. Their job is to have answers. That's what their job in life is. You're an expert. You have to have answers. They just make stuff up. And once they make it up, it becomes like a gospel that they have to defend at all costs. So this the original thing they made up was that Khufu did the Great Pyramid, and his son and grandson did the other two, and then that all happened within a 100-year period without them really realizing that in doing that, they were boxing themselves into the absurd position of having 6 million stones put down in 100 years, and that again is one stone every 8 minutes, 24 hours a day, round the clock, which is absolutely impossible for those 100 years to get it all done. So, and yet they still defend it because that was the original thing that they came up with in the 1800s, and they're stuck with it, and they defend it to this day, even though it's clearly absurd and obvious that it couldn't have been the way they say it was.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, it's your turn. Hi there. Hello. Well, let's see where he is. Go ahead.
Yes, I got a question for Lloyd Pye. By the way, okay. That's for you, George.
There you go. Okay, thanks.
I've always had a thought ever since I was young that I always got a little bit nervous on the longest day of the year and on the shortest day of the year, because the reason why we have the seasons is because the Earth wobbles. And I've always had the thought, well, what if it wobbled down or up in the longest day of the year or the shortest day of the year, and it just didn't come back, and it just kind of fell over? I'd like to have Lloyd Pye's opinion on that. It's just a thought I had, maybe kind of crazy, but...
Well,
my answer off the air.
I'm not sure that, you know, I'd want to call anybody crazy, but I don't really think that that's something that you need to lose sleep over. The Earth just tipping completely over that way. Now, magnetism, it's clear that the poles change, the magnetic poles do change. I don't think that's a function of physical flipping of the Earth itself. I think that is, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the electric universe, that the electromagnetic forces, if you look at a picture of Earth looking at the magnetic lines around it swirling up and down out of the poles, that's where the lines of force are strongest, at the poles. And so, just like with an electromagnet, those can flip depending on the outside forces. And it's clear that that's happened many times in the past on the Earth, and it could happen again. I don't think that means physical disaster with the globe spinning, because if it did, then I really think we'd all be in a world of hurt. I don't think that happens. It could be wrong, because you have those frozen mammoths with the buttercups in their mouths, and that's hard to explain. I'm not saying that it's absolutely impossible, but it doesn't to me seem possible based on what I know.
Okay, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Mr. Pye?
Yes.
You and I had correspondence many years ago. I listened to George's programs every night. And when I hear you discussing where human beings came from, I never hear a distinction on the different races of the human beings, you know? Would it be possible, Mr. Nye, that for each race there was an Adam and an Eve brought to Earth from the planet on which they were given birth, and now we have destroyed our natural heritage, and now, of course, all the different races mixed together, and we have what we got now, as well as every animal, as well as every plant, as well as any mammal in the ocean, came here, were seeded here. The Earth was seeded here. Since I called in about a year ago from giving a message from the Federation of the Universe, I have heard George repeatedly, when this comes up for discussion, use the expression, "Don't you think the Earth was seeded?" Yes, the Earth was seeded. For each race, there was an Adam and an Eve.
I like this theory, Lloyd. What do you think?
Well, it certainly is possible because of the distinction of the races. However, what works against that argument is this. Genetically, human beings are incredibly, incredibly similar. So similar that we're really not far from clones. Now, if you look at the cheetah, they're much closer to clones than we are. But the way science explains it is that we went through some kind of inexplicable bottleneck in the past, such that all of humanity somehow was weeded down to just a few dozen breeding pairs from which we all spring within the last 200,000 years. This is how they explain the suddenness of our appearance. The problem with it is we are all still so much alike genetically that there is more variation. You take a standard troop of chimps or a standard group of gorillas out in the wild, within those 20 or 30 members, there is more genetic variation with any two of them within a group that has a lot of inbreeding in it. There's more genetic variation within any two of them than there is between any two humans. So anywhere. So we're very, very similar genetically. So it argues against that the races were brought from somewhere else. I'm prepared to believe pretty much the argument as it stands that once we split up from the seed group that we were developed from, if you go by the Sumerians, there were seven breeding couples, 14 beings that started us, that they created, and then from them spun off all of us. And then in isolated breeding populations, our races developed. To me, that's the most likely thing based on what I know about the genetics of us as we are now. But I will admit that there are some very distinctive differences in the races, and the idea of isolated breeding populations for me means that they had to have been isolated for quite some time to get as distinctive as they are.
Okay, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with our very special guest, Mr. Lloyd Pye. Very fascinating book, by the way, out there called Everything You Know Is Wrong. Couple websites, LloydPye.com, StarChildProject.com, both linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Lloyd, someone somewhere created the Creator. Somewhere. But where? Hello, Lloyd. Are you
yes.
there?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
There you go. I lost you there. Somebody
I thought
created...
you were just pontificating there.
I am, but I want you to give me a reaction to my pontification.
Well, you know, that comes down really to first cause. That's kind of, I think, the term now that's coming into favor to discuss, you know, what kicked it all off. And there, in the future, when we were talking earlier, and I said that evolution's going to fall, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's got to go down, and something has to take its place. What I think it's going to break into a two-part puzzle at that point. We will have to deal with ourselves. It'll be clear that we were genetically engineered, and so were the domesticated plants and animals, and we'll have to come to terms with the existence of superior beings at some point in the past and probably out there now. But then when it comes to first cause, who created them and who created those that created them and how far does it go? We have to get, that's why I think the electric universe discussion was important. We have to get past the idea that the universe is finite. I don't think that it is. And when we get to the understanding or the acceptance of the electric universe and its infinite capacities there, it opens us up to the idea that there is so much more going on than we can imagine right now. And the first cause out there beyond that is going to be unknowable to us. We'll know that it's out there. We'll know something's out there. But we're not going to know what it is until and unless, I think, something comes to tell us, something that knows the answer tells us. I don't think we're going to be able to get to it on our own steam, carrying the brains in our heads that we have now, the very limited capacities that we have. To us, we seem very, very smart, obviously, but to those out there who created us and who are, you know, who stand in layers behind them, perhaps, we're, you know, idiots, basically, compared to them, because they have full use of their brains, which we might get, like I said, somewhere a couple hundred years down the line, and then maybe we can figure it out. I think there is an answer, but for the time being, in the immediate future, if we get past 2012, I think it's going to break into a two-part puzzle, trying to figure out the mechanics of how we got to be here physiologically, how the genetics, how we were genetically engineered, and then there will be the higher where religion and other things will continue to exist, trying to figure out the reality of the first cause.
Are you a believer in life after death?
I really think there might be more. Really, based again on my research, I'm thinking that there is so much more that we don't understand. And the evidence, you know, Michael Cremo's evidence and other evidence for that is so good, for the paranormal is so good and so strong. Even though I spent a lot of my younger years being fairly agnostic about it and thinking, nah, that's not really possible. I'm coming to change as I get older, and I don't think because I'm getting older, I just learn more, and as I learn more, it seems to indicate to me that the possibility of life after, if not life, something, some spiritual quality of existence, I think might well be possible.
Okay, back to the phones we go, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with Lloyd Pye. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, sir.
Yeah, my name is Nathan. I'm calling from North Carolina. And I'd just like to sort of point out that, like, so many, and this was just reinforced a second ago, so many of these theories seem based on this sort of defeatist notion that humans, especially ancient humans, just, like, couldn't, like, the theories are true because so-and-so could not have done that or could not have known that, and specifically with, you know, the ancient people. And sort of an example is the thing with the Atlas statue. It's pretty standard at this point that, you know, there was tremendous knowledge of astronomy in the ancient world. And the Greeks especially elevated, they had telescopes, like very powerful telescopes. And it's actually been recently sort of, like, the thinking at this point is that the actual carvings on the Atlas statue represent a lost star map from the Greek era. It's just this weird esoteric notion that so many of these theories have, is that, you know, that there's some sort of outside force that either has to, you know, help the poor humans or hurt the poor humans. But, and, you know, whereas humans have done so many, you know, incredible things that most people wouldn't guess that ancient people had telescopes and, you know, and had tremendous knowledge of that thing. You know, I mean, the whole flat Earth theory didn't come around. That's like sort of like a Middle Ages, you know, view when sort of literal word-for-word belief in the Bible was necessary for survival in, you know, European society. It's not how it always was. And I don't know. I don't really know where I'm going with this big ramble.
Well, I can tell you that I think you're off on a wrong track in this sense. The Greeks, I don't care if you gave the Greeks the Mount Palomar telescope that we have today, which I don't think they had, it still can't see galactic center and know where it is. It's just too far out there, I think.
But that's sort of
also the position that the star map, the planisphere, and that the globe on Atlas's shoulders, the positioning of that was a view from outside the bubble, taken of like 10 times from the sun to Pluto out, looking in. The Greeks didn't know that. They couldn't possibly have gotten that. They couldn't have conceived that. And if you want to give the Greeks credit for having telescopes, then tell me how the Sumerians.
This is something you can look up. I mean, the fact is once you realize how the stars move in the skies, it would be easy to see where the poles are, how it rotates or axis, how some areas move slower and some are faster. It would not be a difficult thing to work out. And it may seem as though the view is taken from the outside, but outside looks an awfully lot like the inside when you're looking out.
The Sumerians, 2,000 years before the Greeks, 2,000 years before the Greeks, without telescopes as far as anybody knows, somehow knew that Uranus and Neptune and Pluto were there, made it very clear in their cylinder seals and in their writings. These things are out there, and here's what they look like. Now, they didn't get that from eye contact, from doing it with their naked eyes, and they didn't do it with telescopes. They said very clearly in their writings, we were told all this by the gods who live among us and who created us and all that. So I'm willing to believe that if the Sumerians were living with gods who created them and who told them all of their astronomical knowledge, and they were the first people to have any kind of an astronomy, and the Greeks, I think, are very, very clear that it passed down to them, as well as the Romans, for that matter, from the Sumerians and from the Babylonians, who got it from the Sumerians, it started at a certain point. And it started by people telling them what it looked like out there and writing it down and giving them the information, and then it just passed down. I never heard of the telescopes that you're talking about with the Greeks. I'm not challenging you on it because I don't know. I've never heard of that. I just have your word for it at this moment that it's true. I've never heard of it. But if it is true, there's so much more information that they simply couldn't have acquired even with telescopes, because the views that they were talking about were just too far out in space looking in. Another point, the Sumerians didn't clock the solar system from the sun out. They clocked it from outside in. The Earth to them was the seventh planet from the outside working in, instead of the third planet from the sun out. Now, why would the Sumerians at 4,000 years ago take that viewpoint unless it was the viewpoint of somebody giving it to them saying, this is the way it is as you move from outside Pluto in?
There's no question something happened on this planet a long time ago, Lloyd. Too many civilizations talk about gods from above.
Exactly.
And as you know, I don't believe in coincidences. Something happened.
That much smoke, got to be a good fire.
You got that right. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, yeah, hi, George. Hi, Lloyd. This is Wayne up here on the Snake River Plains of southern Idaho.
Uh-huh. Hey, Wayne,
I have
you?
A question for Lloyd. I would really like to know his take on you know, the Discovery Channel continually depicts Neanderthals wearing clothes and burying their dead with flowers and having fire and creating fairly complex hunting tools and such, and that can't, I don't see how that can be right if they were hominoids.
That's right. Well, you know, again, on my website there are a series of slideshows that you can see, and one of them addresses this question exactly about how the prehumans are always depicted as looking like, you know, pardon my French, but ugly human beings. You have these extremely ugly faces, but you have human bodies stuck underneath them. This is all part of brainwashing to make everyone believe that they were just a few centimeters away from being human, when in fact their bodies, nothing about their bones indicates that their bodies looked anything like ours. Their bones are much thicker, much more robust than ours. This is all the prehumans up through Neanderthals. Their arms were longer, especially from the shoulder to the elbow, exactly like the hominoids. So that it's 100% true that we are given a very, very distorted version of what the Neanderthals were really like, because even though they've lost them as our, you know, as an ancestor genetically, they were wedded to it for so long that they still have a lot of information that they produced to make a linkage, to make a flow between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, that bad information is still out there. Nobody corrects it. They just leave it.
It's a gap nobody ever filled, right?
Excuse me? I'm sorry?
It's a gap nobody ever filled, you know.
Yeah, there's never been a missing link to fill that gap. But that is just simply bad information that has been overturned by genetic studies, but they're so wedded to the idea that they continue to portray Neanderthals as not far from humans. And there's a whole school of anthropologists who argue about the primitiveness versus the sophistication of the Neanderthals. It's not just me, but I'm just very confident that the Neanderthals, in fact, were hominoids, and if they didn't bury their dead, those that got buried were buried by the Cro-Magnons. They didn't do anything like that. They're not that sophisticated. They're hominoids, period.
Couple more calls to go. First-time caller line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, hi, this is Bruce from Baton Rouge.
Hey, Bruce.
Louisiana. And hi, George and Lloyd. I had a question for you concerning the electric universe.
Okay.
James McCanney, some 20 years ago, wrote of this theory of the magnetic electrical universe and bodies that entered the universal solar system would glow like, comets and things like this, and that interfered with the solar system, our solar system, and caused Earth changes like pole shifts and great floods, and he called it action at a distance, and he's right along the same lines that you guys are talking about concerning the electric universe and the interaction of other planets and things like this. I just wanted to see what you thought about this, and by the way, this is a great program. It's too bad the rest of the world can't stay up at night and go to sleep during the daytime and be as smart as we are. That's good. It's a great program.
Thank you very much. As far as James McCanney's work, he seems to be very, protective about his take on things, and I can appreciate that. But really, the truth of it is, the electric universe theory goes well beyond him and well prior to him. Again, starting with, as George said, Tesla and Birkeland and the Birkeland currents and Hannes Alphen and Emanuel Velikovsky, all these guys were talking about it, long before him. He has his own take and his own spin on it. And certainly he's welcome to that. It's a big body of information, and there's a lot of different angles and slants you can take on it. But it does have some fundamentals that were discovered starting back in the 20s and 30s and then going on through into the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And now it's a recognized and accepted aspect of cosmology.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. I'm Tim from Edwardsville. And one thing that's always really made my skin crawl, it seems to me that every time an archaeologist confronts a structure that they don't understand, it's almost like a default explanation that it must absolutely have something to do with religion or ritual. And I've often thought that 1,000 years from now, after our civilization is history, they might think that perhaps the St. Louis Arch, we worshipped parabolas, or Mount Rushmore is gods, and the
or we did sacrifices
great
on
goddess.
Top of it. Huh? Or we did sacrifices on top of the arch.
Or the Statue of Liberty or whatever. Do you agree with that? Or
I'll tell you what, I don't even think it's going to take 1,000 years. If we look back 300 years, back then, they thought the Earth was flat and that it was the center of the universe. And we look at them and we think, how colossally stupid, how egocentric could you be? Because the evidence was really there for anybody that would look. But, you know, the church kept the lid on it and wouldn't let the information get out to the people who, you know, to the ordinary people. So only a select few really knew the truth about it. So the mass of people thought the Earth was flat, it was the center of the universe. In 300 years from now, maybe only 200 years from now, people are going to look because of the speed with which we acquire knowledge nowadays. If we make it to 200 years from now, people are going to look back on us and think, how could they have been so colossally stupid about biological reality? Back then, the problem was physical reality. We think we are the biological center of the universe, the same way they thought they were the physical center of the universe. And we're just as wrong and badly ignorant of reality today as they were then. And it won't be close to a thousand years before that's going to be as evident to those people as it is to us that our ancestors were badly, badly wrong, and that's one of the reasons I call my book Everything You Know Is Wrong. I think really basically fundamentally most of what we think is right today and true today is wrong.
Why is it that they don't seem to want to ascribe any practical value to some of the wonderful structures that existed in prehistoric times, but that they were simply religious ceremonial places, you know?
They just don't want to deal with it. It's just too hard. It's just too hard to deal with a reality that is so far over and above their heads, their ability to recreate, to understand. You know, if that was your job, to know everything about a certain field, and there's this big, ugly lump in it that you can't understand and nobody you know can understand, what would you do? You'd just turn away and go, you know, dig up clamshells or something. You'd do something different. You wouldn't want to deal with this thing. And that's what they do. They just try to make up, they try to explain things away rather than actually explain things, because it's just so much simpler and emotionally comforting to just explain it away with ridiculous, you know, answers and trust me because I'm the expert kind of thing and leave me alone and let me go about collecting my paycheck and doing my real work.
Lloyd, very quickly, what are you doing in the conferences and travels?
Nothing, George, right now. I'm finishing a book about the Star Child that I've been working on for most of this year. I expect to have it done by the end of this year. And when the book is finished, I hope to spend next year doing a documentary about the Star Child, and hopefully the documentary and the book will come out together at the same time at the end of the year. That's my plan for right now.
Well, it's been a passion. It's been your life for a number of years.
Man,
though,
about 7 years next year, yeah.
Well, let's hope one day you get the answers you're looking for. Thanks again.
Close.
Appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I've loved it.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasori in Punnett, and Mr. Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.